Hello again, Bob Chaundy here with another Considering Art podcast in which I talk to an artist about their work and something of their life. My guest today is one of Britain's leading stone sculptors, Paul Vanstone. You see, he's even got stone in his name. Paul handpicks blocks of stone, particularly marble, from quarries across the world. Then, with classical carving techniques honed in Italy and India, he transforms them into elegant human forms, some with a delicate covering of cloth. He's influenced by classical sculpture, but there's a modern touch too in his minimalist approach. Paul has an MA from the Royal College of Art and spent 5 years working with the acclaimed British sculptor Anish Kapoor. He's had exhibitions at many major galleries and has shown works in the British Museum, Tate Modern, as well as the V&A. Then there are his commissions, which grace many a public and private space. I visited Paul in his outdoor studio in the west of London. Paul, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. What a pleasure. What an honour. Thank you very much for letting me be on it.
Well, we're standing in your workyard,
yeah,
in your Kilburn studio. Tell me a bit about it. It's quite sprawling and it's huge, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it was one of those moments about 14 years ago where it was like, who dares wins, hopefully, or who dares goes bankrupt. And I took the lease of this large warehouse behind us with a carpenter from my previous studio, Great Western Studios. And we, over the years, sort of scraved, borrowed, built 40 studios for 40 artists. And there is actually a real demand for studio space of a certain size.
Yeah, you don't have to tell me. I've met so many artists who are having to leave London because of the rents and the lack of space and so on.
It's a real issue, actually, which I've never really heard talked about. But anyway, that's for another day.
Yeah.
And so all I wanted was this car park. To tell you the truth, this was the car park to the building. And it's been the most fantastic place to work. On that side is the railway line. And, I mean, cars do park here, but I'm the landlord, so if there's a problem, it's their problem, not mine. So I'm very lucky to have this wonderful studio in not too far out of London. And the railway line allows that to happen because of the dust and the noise. And, you know, it's been a great, productive studio. And I've loved it here. I built everything you can see, so the covered area and the containers. But basically, as we talked about as you arrived, I love working outside. When you're carving, there's a lot of dust and noise, so it's actually much healthier to be outside. And my ego loves working on these big projects, so to be able to do those two things, you need space.
Yeah, I should say that we're surrounded by torsos, by heads, by
wings.
wings, indeed, yeah. Have you always been a maker, Paul?
It's where I'm profoundly from, really. I mean, it's interesting, my daughter's at Goldsmiths at the moment, and I went to St Martin's and then the Royal College, but the Goldsmiths seems to have quite a sort of conceptual base, you know, a kind of structured theory to their work practice, which I'm finding very interesting it coming out in what she talks about. But basically my background is in love of making things and just seeing where that takes you, really. It's an intuitive, I don't make models. To tell you the truth, I do very little drawing. It's straight onto the block and off we go. I mean, there are things I want to make and love making, but it's very intuitive and I stand and fall by that, really. It's dangerous carving with, you're reacting, you're balancing, a bit like you would with a painting, rather than, say if you were casting something into bronze. You initially make a model and then, you know, take a cast, and there's a structure to it which means there's going to be an end result, really. Whereas with carving, it's like this, it's much more open. And I love that kind of, there's an element of risk-taking to it, but, also it gives you something new each time, which I love, you know.
When did you first fall in love with sculpture?
Sculpture. I loved objects, really. Just the love of objects, I think. My mum and dad had taken me to museums when I was young, you know, the Tate and the British Museum. I just think extraordinary objects still kind of grab me, whatever they are. It doesn't need to be sculpture. It can be ceramics or, you know, all sorts of things. Boulders, rocks. My dad loved being in the mountains, so he took us to the Alps and the Pyrenees and to Scotland, so being around stone, I think, probably was a big influence.
Aren't you a bit of a rock climber yourself?
I was, until I kind of grew more rotund in life, but I do love, I was in the Dolomites last year, I do love being in the mountains, and stone has that, without being too pretentious about it, has a kind of vibrancy about it, which an energy which I love. You know, it kind of, it grounds me, you know, without being, I don't want to be pretentious about it, but and different blocks of stone have different effects, and that I find fascinating, has gripped me for 36 years.
You particularly like marble.
Yes.
And what is it about marble that fascinates you?
I think, I mean, my classic answer to this is that it gives you extraordinary things back, from colour to texture to, I always think that it's a little bit like skin. It absorbs but also reflects light. So if you are trying, I am a figurative artist, if you are trying to portray skin and the human form, it has those qualities about it, which, you know, human beings have. It's obviously not. And there's this contrast between this hard substance and the softness of skin. But it's also like with the cloth pieces, with the wings, you're playing on that contradiction of a hard material which portrays soft things, delicate things, intimate things, you know, those things.
The thing about marble is that you use so many types of marble from different countries,
yeah.
And they all have their different qualities.
Yeah.
Can you give me a few examples? I mean, I see behind us I think that's Bolivian marble, isn't
precisely.
It?
Precisely.
So where does that blue, that hugely blue pigment, oh, not pigment, but
it's a mineral, so yeah. It would be a mineral. I was in Carrara in Italy this summer, and I'd been commissioned to make a piece, a torso in the blue, years and years ago, and I made a piece, I bought the piece through a dealer, and I knew nothing of its history, and I was interested, you know, I like to, quite a lot of time I like to go to the quarries. I didn't go to Bolivia. I would love to go to Bolivia and go to the quarry, but I didn't in this case. I bought it from the grandson of the original guy who set up the quarry, and he talked to me about this journey that his grandfather had gone, leaving Italy at the end of the Second World War, the poverty in Italy, trying to find a new life, trying to, you know, to be entrepreneurial. He'd found himself in Lima in Peru. He'd met a guy who'd seen this blue mountain in outside of La Paz in Bolivia, and he said, look, being from a quarrying family, he said, well, let's go and see if we can get the rights to quarry it, and that's how the quarry was set up. And I think those individual stories about materials I find fascinating. I love going to quarries. These 2 5-ton blocks of Portuguese are from a quarry I've been visiting for 27 years now, and I love that relationship between, you know, the coming out of the ground, talking to the not salesman, not the owner, but the quarryman. It's usually, unfortunately, it is always men, but about the material. You know, it's kind of like a painter sourcing a blue. You know, you know to get that quality you want, you go right down to the source. And it starts in the quarries for me.
But you mentioned the Portuguese marble. Now,
yes.
I've seen some of your work in Portuguese marble, and
yes.
Some of it is pink.
Yes.
And some of it isn't.
Some of it's grey. Some of it's this is pink with blue mauve veining in it. I mean, it's if you go to Carrara in Italy, like the wings are made from Carrara. Sorry, and it is a very consistent marble. So if you're laying a floor in an airport, you can have that consistent, elegant grey across it. You know, and that gives it a huge value, and why it's been one of the most quarried materials in the world. Portuguese marble is not like that. It has character and colour and veining, and it's crazy and passionate, almost passionate. And it's, and if you laid a floor in an airport in it, you'd be going, "Whoa, you know, that's spaghetti or what, you know." But I love, you know, but for, I mean, they do use it for bathrooms and obviously, you know, and that's the majority of its use. But to carve it, it's a joy. It's very, it's quite a hard material. It keeps a beautiful polish in quite extreme climates. But you can get these beautiful crisp edges to portray you know, the things you want to portray.
And the veins that you mentioned, are they all minerals, are they?
Yes, so it'll be this extraordinary mixture of minerals. Marble has, it has a sedimentary, it has a series of backgrounds to it, but then, you know, it's it has another history. It has a heat element to it, or a compression to it, which creates marble. So it's gone through various processes to get there, and depending on the minerals you start with, you get these incredibly beautiful materials to work in, you know. And I'm seduced by it. It's a seductive material, and I think in a way, you know, you get seduced by it, and you've got to kind of wrap yourself up in that. And yeah.
Okay, let's take another one. Moroccan marble. I've seen your work, and it's real, like ebony black, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, is that a did you find a block that was particularly black, or was it all black there?
No. You need to dig around and get dirty. I kind of love that side of things. I love the contrast. You know, the blacks have a kind of crispness to them. And to tell you the truth, I mean, I've carved, you know, matching the subject with the material and the scale is what my career has been. If I kind of define it as anything, that getting better at doing those things, I hope. And blacks, you can't, I struggle to do very detailed things in blacks. So you're looking at more broad volumes and shapes. But they have it has a glorious kind of, you know, I love the kind of, you know, it absorbs you in black, and you know, you kind of see the really see the surface.
There's another one I noticed called Indian Rainforest.
Yes, glorious.
That's extraordinary. I mean, the colours of sort of the earth, the green.
Yes. Ironically, last time I went to Rajasthan, the quarry where I went to had been in a drought for 7 years. They're not in a rain for 7 years. And there is this beautiful kind of sumptuous green, once polished, it has this wonderful sumptuous greens from the, you know, from the garden, from nature, you know, and you think it's come from this luscious place, but it couldn't be. The more opposite, it's a very dry, dusty place, but fantastic material. Every single block is different from one to the next, and you make something and people fall in love with it, and then somebody else wants something, you know. It's the bane of a lot of art, you know. People want that. And oh, could you make something similar? And it was always going to be completely different, you know. And in a way, in a mass-produced world, the individual, unique object, I think, just keeps on getting redefined. And I love the unique object.
When you go to a quarry, like you mentioned, the Portuguese quarry.
Yeah.
If you were a kitchen manufacturer and you wanted a whole load of marble, then you buy. Obviously a lot, but you're a sculptor, so you're buying presumably in quite small quantities, are you?
Relatively, yes. I mean, the last container I brought here had 26 tonnes in it.
Oh my God, that sounds a lot.
It sounds a lot, but if you think your classic sea container, that the maximum it can take is 26 tonnes. And so that volume, it is quite a lot of volume, but like these two blocks, I will try and get these ready for the flower show, which is in 4 months' time.
You know, that's at Chelsea Flower Show.
Yeah, so you know, it's like any material. You know, I personally love the difference. You know, if you get used to working in bronze, you know, in a way, stone allows me to do quite big. You know, I don't have a huge amount of money behind me or budgets to make things, so it allows me to experiment with things without huge costs. I mean, to make something like that size in bronze would £50,000 or something, and to buy that block, you know, is considerably less, you know. But anyway, that's the that side of things.
So when you're at a quarry, be it in Portugal or in India or wherever, does the end product, so to speak, is that determined by what you discover in the marble itself?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I love that. I mean, you can turn up. You know, last time I was there in last autumn, I went twice actually to sections of the quarry. I had this lovely moment. It must be now almost 18 years ago. I was up in a quarry They're quite dangerous places, quarries, actually, to tell you the truth. And they do need to be, they are heavily regulated. And I was there on my own, and a guy drove up in a Jeep and sort of shouting at me in Portuguese. And I put my arms up like, you know, I'd been caught, you know, walked down. And by the time I got to the bottom, he was laughing. And he turned out to be the owner of all the quarries I could see. And we became firm friends. Has enormous love of art and geology and this lovely mix, which I love. And we became firm friends, and he took me into his office, and there was this map of the quarry. And so, going back to the conversation about trying to find consistent colours, you see sections of the quarry where they were trying to find the pink, the same pink. So you see this sort of multi-million pound business looking at all these different swatches of pink, you know, these big burly quarrymen talking about shades of pink and cream. And I love that sort of aesthetic meeting huge business. Sorry, I've wandered off your question. But I think the more you go and look at it, I mean, I have friends who may buy from photographs, whereas I love to just get on a flight, go to Lisbon. It's only a few hours outside of Lisbon, and, you know, see it, you know. I think that all accumulates, that, you know, those references and what you see, and often what you see and reject helps you choose the next thing, you know.
Now, you mentioned Carrara. Now, yeah. After you graduated from Royal College of Art,
that's right.
You went to Pietrasanta.
Yes.
Is that the sort of step that sculptors sort of part of their ambition to go there? And is it a kind of apprenticeship when you do get there?
Yeah, I mean, we don't have a history of working in marble in this country. It's a foreign material. I mean, I was taught by a guy called Chris Haysom at St Martin's, whose family owned the Haysom quarry in Purbeck, and they call it Purbeck marble. Down in this Swanage, it's not a marble. It's a hard limestone, a beautiful material, but not marble. And so to go to Italy and work sweeping floors, watching what people use, tools, ways around problems into little nooks and crannies, you know, what to use, was deeply valuable to me. And, you know, looking at why someone selected one block instead of the other. I mean, I went on to work for Anish Kapoor for 5-6 years.
I'll come on to that.
And that really, actually, that really helped. I went from Carrara to Jaipur, and I worked in some workshops there, and I picked up a whole new set of references there. But in Carrara, there is that, you know, it's been passed down for many, many generations, and you get this ease of understanding, which was wonderful to see. I mean, I think it's evolving. The robots have coming into that industry, and, yeah, a little less romantic than you think. But I think, you know, as I go, but I think the individual unique object won't disappear.
Are you serious about the robots? I mean,
yeah,
they are, what, quarrying the marble?
Well, they have them in the quarries, but also, like, I think for the last 20 years I've seen a statue of David, Michelangelo's David, full size, so that's a pretty big statue, you know, 4 metres tall, being made on a robot. And each time I see the next David, it's that much better. Saying that, it always needs, you know, the surface and the human, it needs a artigiani to work with what comes off the robots, you know, the bench, you know, the work table. So it's that balance. I mean, in a way, it's great for copying things. I don't have any problem with that. I think making unique objects, I don't really understand how that works, but maybe I'm old-fashioned, you know. But
yeah, but maybe in a few years' time, the technology develops so quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah, but I don't, you know. I guess I go back to that analogy of a painting. Could someone stand behind a robot and program it to do the painting for them? But it's such an intuitive series of multiple actions, a jigsaw puzzle of actions which create that painting. And I would say that's how I'm working with the car. I'm reacting to what's happening to me. It's not a doodle. It's not a. There's not drifting. It's a reaction, a counter reaction, and unless you're there, I suppose you could, you know, use the robot to do each motion, and you just sit back in an armchair. But still, I think that physical, what you physically can, you know, if you looked at a Jackson Pollock painting, you know, you're seeing his action, and you. That's a human action onto a canvas. Mm. And then could you get a robot to do that? I think it would be something different, you know. Always. I don't know, you can argue these things.
You mentioned that you worked for 5 years with Anish Kapoor.
Yeah.
What did that teach you?
I think there's a wonderful... And I remember him talking about what sculptors from this country worked on scale in a confident way. And he said to me, you know, it's only really one person, that was Henry Moore. And, you can argue, obviously, Hepworth did some big things, but it wasn't a major section of her working life. I mean, I think I love her work, but it's more intimate, you know. And I think, the first thing I worked on was a 30-ton block of pure white marble from the island of Thassos in Greece. And just to be able to get your head around that and make something extraordinary... And, you know, the finances to be able to do that was just gives you such confidence in what you can do. I mean, he wasn't an easy person to work for. But he's a genius and he's demanding. But you get these extraordinary things, you know, which come out. You know.
And your other influences?
Me?
Apart from the classical, obviously.
I mean, right the way across, when you carve things in stone, you join the history of people who've made things in stone. And what can come out. And I love that, whether it's scratching two eyes and a nose and a mouth onto a cape or a bit of stone, a soft stone, it's portraying something, this feel that we need to do this need of portraying, having something to bridge the gap. I think making objects helps bridge that gap between our fears and, and having a window into a different worlds and things like that, but probably being pretentious now. But
did you find when you went to Rajasthan that the carving techniques were in any way different to those in the West?
I think probably falsely at the time I thought I was going back to a time when I worked in a workshop where someone would, the most experienced carvers would work on the head and the hands. Your apprentice would be the one chopping out the rough areas. And at the time, I probably thought that this is a systemized, this is how the Egyptians made pieces. This is, how cathedrals made, you'd have a hierarchy. And that's, that is that. But at the time, I thought maybe that's still stuck in the past. But actually, oddly, going to work for a contemporary artist like Anish Kapoor, at times he's more like an architect, and you need that structure to make these extraordinary things. And I think working within that group in Jaipur in that little tiny workshop with earth floors was incredibly sophisticated. The pieces they were making were incredibly sophisticated. They were within patterns of what had been made before. But there was plenty of variety there though and passion, and I loved it. Just a different set of skills. And for what I do, I think that balancing act was great between the more industrialized working in Carrara compared to, it's those...
Yeah,
surely that's changed now as well. That was quite a long time ago.
But yeah, has your style developed quite a lot since those days?
I don't know if I have a style. There's things I want to make, and I think if I look back at things I make, there is a pattern, and I think I can see that's... But I think the same subjects that I keep returning to, either I'm failing to get to that point I want to get to say, okay, that's the best, or it's just fascinating me again,
And one of your hallmarks, I think, are this sort of flowing, covering cloth that you breathe life into the stone making it.
Thank you. Well, the cloth pieces I love. I mean, I just love that. I can't get away from that. Again, as I said earlier, the contradiction between, this hard material and creating this fluid sculpture. And I love that, there's a seduction there, I think. And I love that it sort of draws your eye and it holds your eye. And I love that and what it does, where it takes you.
It reminds me a bit of the sort of curvaceousness of Zaha Hadid, in her work.
Yes, yeah, very much so. It's the line, isn't it? It's that quality of line. Yeah, you can see that her buildings are such quality. I've got a client in Abu Dhabi and there's a bridge which spans where they live. Towards where the new Louvre museum is, and the main section of Abu Dhabi city itself, and there's a Zaha Hadid bridge which spans a creek between the two. And you can't, oddly, when you get on the bridge, you can't really see it. So their driver took me off the bridge one day, down onto this dirt road, down to the creek, but you know, the estuary entrance. And you looked across and suddenly you saw this beautiful flow of the bridge, which nobody really sees. But she knew it. She's, you know, and incredible. I was so sad that she, yeah. she I mean, obviously she gave so much in those, I don't know, she was in her 60s, wasn't she, I think, when she died. She gave so much, maybe that's what she had, I don't know. But so sad that she died as young as that.
Yeah. When you're carving a face, Paul, do you ever think about the expression that you're going to put on it?
Oddly, I don't tend to go for overt expressions. I feel, you know, you're setting, you know, literally setting something in stone, and I think often they're in materials which have quite a lot of vibrancy in them. So in a way, it's got to be a form which holds that balance between, you know, what's underneath, that the minerals can take over. You know, if you make smaller pieces, the scale compared to the veining is quite important, because it can take over and you can't see it anymore. You know, it's lost in what's in the stone, particularly the minerals I choose. So I've steered away from overt. So they tend to be, I hate to use this word, slightly more timeless, you know, less, you know, more kind of clean.
When you're doing a commission,
yeah,
how much preparatory work do you have to do beforehand to assess what it's going to be like, given the situation that it's going to be in, the site?
I do like to go to the site. I do like to meet. I mean, I do. I strongly feel, and you read about it with much grander commission, you know, than I do, that relationship between the client, the commissioner, and you. I love working with people. I do find that staying close to the things I love gets the most out of me, so I do say that to people. So I do find that when people come to me, that they've already, you know, that they've had a response to what I made before. With most artists, I think if I was suggesting something to a commissioner, is try and pick the right artist for the right. It's obvious, but you see it as a bit of a pitfall in a lot of public commissions. I think they try and squeeze artists into doing things that they wouldn't naturally do, and I kind of think that selection process, you know, it's not easy. But I just think it'd be much better to try and find the right artist, to find the right work within their, or you know, pieces they make for that spot, rather than squeeze something out of someone which ticks a load of boxes, you know. Not easy.
Obviously, scale then comes into it very much so, isn't it, on a commission, because you have to make whatever it suits.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, and I delivered in the autumn a piece to a garden up the other side of Leicester, a beautiful old estate, and one of the big factors in it was that they didn't want any heavy lifting machinery anywhere near the site. So we had to put this 5-ton marble head, but it had to be manually assigned with lifting equipment, but it had to be all carried onto site and all put up, and then this 5-ton head put onto its base, onto its stainless steel pin, and that was quite committing. It took about 3 attempts to do it, and but it did in the end. It's just, you know, when you apply that much pressure to soft ground, it's fine. You know, a lot of equipment is made for workshops or hard ground. As soon as you get off that onto soft gardens, it can be, you have to be careful, you know, safety wise.
You don't really consider what logistical problems
and at times maybe I underestimate it. I'm generally life an optimist, but at times I perhaps should be more pessimistic. But you know, I don't know, we got to the end of doing this setup, and they're very happy with the piece. And it needed to be a big piece to read from, you know, it was quite a distance from the house, the property. So to read well, it needed to be that. It wasn't just my ego. It needed to read well from that. So, I mean, it's lovely to work on a bigger, broad brushstroke, you know. But it was, very committing.
and it must be rather nice when, you know, the commissioner says, oh, that's a fantastic. Have you got any favourite sort of feedback?
It's a very nervous moment for an artist. I mean, what I tend to do in the commissioning process is send images right the way through, so there is no terrible surprise right at the end. It's not what I wanted. And again, you're making a unique thing. It's going to be different. It's never been made before. So lots and lots of photographs. Please come and look at it anytime you want. You know, come in, see what's being made. We can talk about it. To a degree, things can be tweaked. Often people have never been in this process before, so you're steering them. But it is, you know, they're living with it for the rest, you know, and these things are going to last for hundreds of years. I think it would be very arrogant not to take into consider their life with the object.
Of course.
And so it's a matching.
Is working with alabaster and onyx a very different ballgame?
Yes, yes. I mean, it's a bit like bronze or aluminium, you know. They're very different properties. Alabaster is one of the world's great, beautiful materials. You can carve it with a sharp knife. The alabaster I buy is from Zaragoza in Spain, and if you go into the city of Zaragoza, it's a beautiful city actually. It has a cathedral in the middle with an altarpiece which is 10 meters tall, made in alabaster. I mean, incredible. Such a beautifully malleable material. It wants to be worked, and it gives you all these options of things you can make. So very fluid. Onyx is brittle, hard, full of colour, wonderful, exciting veins, transparency. You know, it's a luminous, I mean, as is alabaster, you know, but it's brittle, it's slightly sort of unforgiving if you get it wrong, but it's full of colour and, you know, has a wonderful vibrancy to it, which I love. So very different materials, very different from marble as well. Most alabaster really can't go outside. It's mostly is inside. I mean, it will last for 20, 30, but it will eventually dissolve. So.
And presumably getting it wrong is something you do fewer times now, is it?
Yes, I always say I'll bankruptcy awaits. There's nothing propping this up apart from selling the next piece of work. So, okay. But yeah, no. It is a natural material, and I guess if I go back to choosing it, you know, you're cutting down the risk of there being faults. And but also, you can destroy things within minutes unless you're concentrating. But almost in a way, that's what's great about it, because boredom has always been my big battle. And it keeps you on your toes, you know. Oh,
so. Well, let's hope bankruptcy waits a long, long time.
Thank you
very much,
no,
Paul,
not at
for
all.
This.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Paul Vanstone. You can feel the passion he has for stone in his voice and, of course, in his works. Thank you for listening. This is Bob Jaundy saying, see you next week.